You're listening to BreadboxMedia.com. And I'm Chuck Coughlin, and what I do is set the record straight here on Setting the Record Straight. How you doing today? What are we doing today? We're considering the power of Islam, which at some times in the last 13th century has been very, very powerful indeed. The more you know about that history, most especially in the few centuries surrounding the year 1000, the less smug the occupants of Christendom should feel. Our security in relationship to the Muslim world is a very recent event, and we paid a great price over and over again for that hard-won superiority. This is often forgotten. Maybe it's usually forgotten. We're taking our superiority in a number of fields relative to the Islamic world for granted and projecting it onto our view of earlier centuries. We have a military advantage for sure, economic advantages for sure, and certainly technological superiority relative to the Islamic world. But that wasn't always so. With the luxury of hindsight, many Western historians look back at the expansion of Islam in the context of a decaying Byzantine Empire. And our opinions have been shaped in a way that looks back at the expansion of Islam. And we regard the medieval crusades as prequels to modern Western imperialism. And movies and TV series depict the crusades as paroxysms of Catholic religious fanaticism. What an incorrect analysis this is. What an example of distorted hindsight. They fail to realize that for centuries, Catholicism in the Western world and Christendom was tipping on the edge of defeat. Crusading ideals in Western Europe were an answer to the greater threat of jihad. They were spurred by fear and necessity in a desperate competition with Islam that for many centuries Catholics lost and were aware that they were losing. The extent and power of Islam's victories can be seen in the all but complete disappearance of the once thriving Christian communities in North Africa, the Middle East, and Western Asia, as well as the deep roots that Islam still has in the Balkans, a region whose very name was imposed upon it by Turkish Islamic imperialism in the late medieval period. Islam is a remarkably successful religion that for most of its existence has inspired adherents to creatively synthesize the often conflicting requirements of warfare, imperial politics, and missionary zeal. Projecting Western freedom of action backward in time seriously distorts the more dramatic story of ongoing Western weakness that almost destroyed us. Much of the fury in contemporary radical Islam's protest against the West, not at all fueled by aggrieved victimhood or the pain of open wounds left by the Crusades 1,000 years ago. Until the last few decades, the Crusades have been almost forgotten by the Islamic world. Or if remembered at all, remembered as a very minor incident. No, it's nourished by an even stronger memory of how Islam's final victory over Christendom was frustrated at the very last moment, just before their complete success. The fervent and furious jihad we're experiencing today is not inspired by pain and bitterness over their losses long ago. No, it's inspired by the pride and confidence in the great series of victories they've had over us throughout history. And now they reemerge after a relatively quiet period. They remember that they had victory snatched from them by events that occurred at the very last moment before their triumph was complete. They're inspired by their series of great victories they gained over Christendom, one after another, right up to the edge of defeat. They almost did it. We were down to the last quarter and down by many points. Muslim triumphs in early centuries were the crucible that forged both Christendom's fear and Islam's confidence. So let's take up some historical events. Let's put on our time transport boots and jump to the year 1071. 1071 Anno Domini. Here we are. Look around. After centuries of struggling jihad, The Muslims have just defeated the Christians in a great victory. The Seljuk Turks have just crushed the Byzantine army on the plains of Manzikert. The scimitar of Islam extended from Spain through North Africa and encompassed the Middle and Near East. It swept by the very borderlands of Constantinople and stretched far eastward up the Central Asian steppes into the ancient civilizations of India and even China. And yes, it's a big presence there today in Western China. But in the year of 1071, it was a great presence in China already, much more so than in the West, where the Franks, the Normans, and the Holy Roman Empire formed an impenetrable barrier to further Islamic expansion. The Byzantine Empire felt the hot breath of the Muslim invader on its neck. But the Muslims threatened far more than just Byzantium. From the time of Jesus' death, Catholics had made pilgrimages to the Holy Land, in particular to the tomb of Christ, the Holy Sepulchre. Even before Charlemagne, whom the Arabs recognized as the protecting lord of Catholics in the Middle East, Frankish knights had defended Catholic pilgrims on the dangerous journey. In the later chaos of the Dark Ages, the Muslims ravaged and destroyed the Holy Sepulchre and every Christian institution in Jerusalem. In 1027, the Byzantines intervened to guard Christian holy sites and pilgrims. It was a protectorate that lasted less than 40 years before Jerusalem was again submerged under a flood of Islam. Islam would be the most dangerous religious movement to afflict Catholicism until the time of Luther. Like the later Reformation Protestants, the Prophet Muhammad preached a simple, rational religion. Its simplicity is a key. It was a religion of the book, in this case, the Quran. It was a religion of direct communication with God and set daily prayer. It dismissed the sacerdotal hierarchy of Catholic and Eastern Orthodox Christianity. In time, with many early heresies, it did away with the mystery of the Trinity, proclaiming that there was but one God, Allah. His prophets were Moses, Jesus, and most especially Muhammad. Islam's one nod to a priestly caste was to make a religion and state a coherent body, a theocracy, with a single code of law, much as John Calvin would organize in Geneva, and also like the long-living theocracy that Henry VIII would devise in the British Empire. And like the Calvinists, the Muslims believed in predestination. Islam illustrates another important fact of religious life, that heresy builds on heresy. Just as Protestant division begets Protestant divisions, now around 36,000. The Islamics have thousands of sects, all disagreeing. As a matter of fact, there is no central authority within Islam, nothing comparable to the magisterium at all. So all opinions on Islam are subject to being opposed by other Islamics, and it becomes a shapeshifter. You read different books on Islam, and they present no consistent picture. The key is that there is no central authority in Islam. Just sects that drift, even individuals drifting around. It's a shapeshifter. So, heresy builds on heresy. For the lands that fell to Islam from North Africa to Visigothic Spain to the eastern possessions of Byzantium were the areas most profoundly troubled by the earlier heresies from Catholicism. Those known as the Arian heresies. This is where that occurred, in these areas. Aside from its simplicity, Islam appeals to the common man because it offers worldly as well as otherworldly benefits. A man was allowed as many as 4 wives at a time, unless your Muhammad didn't have special dispensation. He had 7. If any of the wives are unsatisfactory, divorce is available, and any number of concubines. It had a creed of holy war that attracted the nomadic tribes of the desert, who could now raid and pillage in the name of God and of divine conquest. Islam provided a creed of self-respecting ethics, and the dismissal of priests flattered the ego, with every man equal before God. No need for humility here. The afterlife promised to the Muslim was a Middle Eastern Trump Tower of luxury, with a virtually inexhaustible supply of houris to satisfy every sexual desire, even despite the teetotaling pledge of the Muslim during his terrestrial life, a heavenly overflowing of intoxicating liquors. Yes, as we know, it's often said, Islam spread by the sword or scimitar, and that is the case. But it also found converts, which, given its promise and its simplicity, shouldn't surprise you. H.W. Crocker has written a sentence that reflects his optimism about Catholicism's superiority and perhaps eventual triumph over Islam. And he says this, "There's something to be said indeed for the idea that the ultimate mysteries and complexities of Catholicism, its affirmation of a tangible divine incarnation in the created world, and its belief in free will, provided the nurturing culture for Western Europe's eventual intellectual, scientific, industrial, and creative superiority over Islam." There's something to be said for that. Just think of the components of that sentence. That there's something to be said for the ultimate mysteries and complexities of Catholicism. An affirmation of a tangible incarnation in the creative world, in the human creative world. A tangible incarnation, an embedding of the spirit within the body, of the divine within the material, and an affirmation of free will over predestination. You know, I feel right now that Crocker has written an entire book in that single sentence. So this tangible incarnation, combined with free will, provided the nurturing culture for Western Europe's eventual superiority, for Catholic Doom's eventual superiority. We'll be back after the break. Chuck Coughlin here on BreadboxMedia.com.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit BreadboxMedia.com.
You're listening to BreadboxMedia.com. And I'm Chuck Coughlin, and what I do is set the record straight here on Setting the Record Straight. We're reflecting on the power of Islam today. And though it's true that a great deal of Islam's power comes from its sword, its scimitar, but it is also true that a great deal of its appeal to the convert comes from the power of its simplicity. The contrast between Catholicism and Islam is interesting. It's quite a dramatic contrast. At the beginning of this program, we spoke of the mysteries and complexities of Catholicism, and why shouldn't it be full of complexities and things mysterious to us? After all, it was not founded, like other religions, by a man. It was founded by God Himself, coming forth from an immense wisdom. Catholicism contains a powerful affirmation of the created world, of the natural world, of nature around us, and the affirmation of a divine incarnation that is tangible, that is touchable. When the resurrected Christ rejoins the apostles after walking with two disciples on the road to Emmaus, the apostles are incredulous. They think he's a ghost, but he says to them, "No, I'm real. Touch and see. Touch and see. He's real." And they give him something to eat, and he eats it. He's resurrected into his glorified body as Christ. Touch and see. We have the Eucharist. If you're a Catholic, you have touched and seen Christ. How can you compare? You can take certain specific areas. Take our music, you can compare that. Take our artworks, you can compare that. Our architecture, you can compare that. All the outgrowths of Catholicism, science, hospitals, you can compare that. But if all you're comparing is all these styles and products and practices, you've missed the whole point of the real comparison. Touch and see. Yes, before the break, we were talking about the technical and cultural superiority that has arisen out of Catholicism. Perhaps the Catholic world that we live in, and that is what it is, though it is not acknowledged so, did provide a nurturing nest for this great civilization. But we can't take that for granted. It's only recently so, and it was not always so. And there was a time that it was on life support. So in our time transport boots, we had stepped back in time to 1071 AD, when the Turks crushed the Christian army on the plains of Manzikert. If we had lived then, we would have been afraid that Christianity was about to be snuffed out because of the great power of Islam. If we had lived back then, we would have had no idea that this mixture in Western Europe of Norseman, German, Saxon, Gaul, and Roman, the compounded spirit of the Celtic chieftain Vercingetorix, of Caesar, of Charlemagne, and of the Catholic Church, would combine and change the world in one of the most extraordinary adventures in the history of mankind. It started with a proclamation from Pope Urban in the 11th century, a reformist in the tradition of Hildebrand. If the modern reader has any doubts about the papacy's undisputed leadership of Christendom, he need only look at the response of all Europe when Pope Urban II proclaimed a crusade to regain the Holy Land and save the imperial Byzantine Christians. Deus le volt was the chant. God wills it. Deus le volt. So the crusades began. We came looking like giant lusty men fed on beef and beer with heavy leather gauntlets and chain mail, mounted on armored horses of enormous size, violent, unforgiving, unretreating, and pious, so pious to a god whose chief ethical demands seemed to be feudal honor, noble independence, and stubbornness. To the medieval nobleman, piety meant a familiar, almost intimate relationship to the human nature of Jesus, to the human nature of Mary, and the human nature of the saints of the church. It included not only what we think of as religious devotion, but also an unswerving loyalty, national pride, chivalry, chivalric honor, and a fierce sense of personal dignity. Western Christianity had very little in common with the philosophical otherworldliness of the Eastern Church. The Frankish knight regarded his obligations to God in very much the same terms as his allegiance to his feudal overlord, wholly sincere and zealously militant. And central to all this was the sword. As a Christian symbol, the sword acquired an even more than ordinary significance. Its shape made it inevitably a makeshift crucifix in times of urgency on the battlefield, and it frequently was used in the last rites of the men killed in action. Having said all this, Islam is a remarkably successful religion that for most of its existence has inspired its adherents to creatively synthesize the often conflicting requirements of warfare, imperial politics, and missionary zeal. Projecting Western freedom of action backward in time seriously distorts the more dramatic story of ongoing Western weakness that almost destroyed Christendom. The pathos and peril of much of the contemporary radical Islam's protest against the West is not fueled primarily by aggrieved victimhood. It is nourished by an even stronger memory of how Islam's final victory over Christendom remained so long a real possibility. Unlike Christianity, which began on the margins of social and political life in the Roman world and stayed there for centuries, Islam quickly achieved a good bit of worldly success. Within a century of the death of the Prophet Muhammad, his followers had overrun most of the southern half of the Mediterranean world. Muslim armies advanced from the Arab Peninsula all the way to southern France, to the west, north to the outlying districts of Constantinople, the greatest city of Christendom, and further eastward to the ancient civilizations of Persia, India, and the easternmost borders of China. In Islam's first centuries, Muslim scholars and jurists formulated their understanding of the religious and political divisions of the world into the Dar al-Islam, or House of Peace, and the Dar al-Harb, the House of War. Dar al-Islam, of course, the House of Peace, are lands dominated and controlled by Muslims, their Muslim lands. Dar al-Harb, are the infidels, lands dominated and controlled by infidels. This is the house of war. While truces between areas that were Dawl al-Islam and areas that were Dawl al-Harb were acceptable, the Quran taught that these were to be limited in duration. Ultimately, no permanent peace between Muslims and non-believers was possible until all non-believers submitted to Muslim rule, and that Dawl al-Islam encompassed the whole world. Jihad, either in the form of the greater jihad, the struggle all Muslims must wage against sin, or the lesser jihad, the armed struggle with non-believers, was integral to bringing wholeness and unity to a divided world. And I want to note that today, the great majority of Muslims understand the jihad, without the adjective greater or lesser, to be the armed struggle against non-believers. I have a certain trust in the sources that report that. Although, as I said, everyone you talk to seems to have a different idea about Islam. So let's return to Islam's early centuries. Islam's original conquests were terrifying in their power and speed. They struck the Mediterranean world at a time when domestic strife and war made a common front against Arab-Muslim expansion impossible. Fierce doctrinal disputes among Christians and a thoroughly exhausting war with the Persians left the world's only major Christian power, Byzantium, unprepared to face a frightfully effective jihad. The various small Catholic and pagan principalities in North Africa and Spain, like the weakened Zoroastrian Persians, were even less able to turn back the Muslim armies. Catholic and Persian weakness and the success of Islam in bringing large tracts of territory under its control produced a range of reaction among Catholics and Muslims. In the West, particularly in Spain, the Muslim religious presence left surprisingly few traces in the sparse Catholic documents of the first century after the conquest. It appears that most Catholics accepted their new Muslim overlords with equanimity. Many found that the collaboration with rulers who were tied into the Dar al-Islam's common market, so-called area of trading, that stretched from Spain to the Hindu Kush in India, was more profitable than resistance against a new ruling class whose demands were not initially onerous and whose military power made resistance futile anyway. The earliest Spanish documents that dwell at any length on the Muslim presence as a religious issue are the works of St. Eulogius, written more than a century after the conquest, in the 1850s. In his writings, he defended the sanctity of Catholic martyrs. He spoke of the 40 martyrs of Cordoba, who had been recently executed for publicly denouncing Islam and the Prophet. Eulogius would soon be killed himself by Muslim authorities for defending the martyrs. He had addressed Catholic objections that those whom the Muslims had executed were not martyrs because they had, quote, suffered at the hands of men who venerated both God and the law, unquote. This illustrates how thoroughly most Spanish Catholics were beaten down and submitted to the Islamic rule. They defined both Muslims and their relation to Islam entirely in Islamic terms.
So in the area we know as Spain and Portugal, many people, many Catholics had become dhimmis. Jews and Catholics had become dhimmis. These people had submitted to their Muslim conquerors. They had become second-class citizens with vastly restricted rights. This is an area often called Andalus, but the Muslims called it Al-Andalus. Make yourself comfortable. We'll be back in a minute. On Breadbox Media, this is Chuck Coughlin setting the record straight.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
You're listening to breadboxmedia.com.
Setting the record straight, and Chuck Coughlin is back after the break. I do hope you found that comfortable place to sit down. And close your eyes and just listen. or lay down. If you go to sleep, you can start the podcast again. It's okay. We're never going to know that we put you to sleep. Don't you love webcasting? I do. It demands so little of you. Oh, yeah, this is the third segment of a show. We were considering what? We're considering the Islamic Jihad in the Iberian Peninsula, present-day France, Spain, and Portugal, and how the jihadists met resistance when they attempted to go northward from Spain into France. Those two nations are separated by the Pyrenees Mountains. So let's take up the story at that point. But Frankish resistance defeated a major Arab raid at Tours. It was in 732 AD, but it was as much their poverty as their arms, and growing divisions among sects within the Dar al-Islam. This was lucky for the Catholics north of the Pyrenees Mountain. It prevented them from being absorbed into the Muslim world and being subjected to demitude, second-class citizens. They were lucky to have the Pyrenees Mountains there. But their warriors get the credit. They were brave and fierce fighters. For most Catholics in the East, however, the initial expansion and stabilization of Islam was an unmitigated disaster. It was made worse by continuing Muslim aggression throughout the 8th century. Beginning in the 7th century, the Byzantines secure their greatly reduced landward frontier in the East through a series of drastic militarizing reforms that turned much of the empire into a garrison state. Though its Muslim neighbors lacked the unity to launch all-out assaults, the constant pressure of Muslim raiders searching for slaves and for loot, as well as the equally permanent threat of Arab piracy throughout the Mediterranean, required Byzantium to remain on a permanent war footing. Somehow, Byzantium endured the centuries-long conflict, even produced a remarkable flowering of its culture at home and abroad. Byzantine missionaries, artists, teachers, and soldiers expanded their empire's cultural, religious, and political influence in the Balkans and southern Ukraine. But this revival took place under the shadow of three increasing threats. The first two were of Byzantium's own making, but forged by the strains of a war for survival. It was its own fractured despotic internal politics and its tortured relations with other Christians, both with older Christian churches to their east and west, as well as northward among the newly Christianized people its missionaries evangelized. Their belief in the empire's mission led by Byzantines to regard their state as the political center of Christendom. But it also produced an imperial arrogance that undermined the empire's ability to cooperate effectively with other Christians. These two factors were rendered more dangerous still by the third factor, the third threat. It was the permanent commitment of Muslims to jihad, a permanent jihad. So in the areas of the Muslims, the Dar al-Islam, the Byzantines faced an enemy that constantly, if time sporadically, renewed his jihad. The Muslim world was strengthened by its contacts with the peoples of Asia and its wider-ranging access to slave labor in Asia and Africa. The original expansion and vast reach of Dar al-Islam, in this way, gradually Islam became more powerful. So during the 10th century, the expansion of the Islamic Empire slowed a bit. There was a modest reconquista of some of its lost territories by the Byzantine Empire. But the Muslim holy warriors launched numerous raids on Byzantine territory throughout the century. The next century, the 11th, opened with a spectacular Muslim success. The Arab sack of the second city of Byzantium, Thessalonica. They enslaved 30,000 Christians. Muslim raiding parties reached far as modern Ankara, deep in Byzantine territory, and took thousands more Christians captive. Muslim writers used Byzantine counterattacks to inflame Muslim opinion and sought to bring about religious revival and greater Muslim commitment to jihad. The great jihadist preacher Ibn Nubata al-Fariki developed an entire cycle of sermons that became the model for such literature for centuries and would later inspire Saladin. So, we come back to 1071. March 13th, by Pope Gregory's calendar. The Byzantine Emperor Romanus IV led one of the largest armies that Byzantium had fielded in centuries out of Constantinople. His purpose was to end the ongoing Muslim raids that were slowly wearing away the defenses of the heartlands of the Byzantine Empire, and especially one of the most ancient centers of Christian life, Anatolia. Today we call this region Turkey. But in the 11th century, this was 100% Christian territory. The sad fate of Romanus's campaign led to Anatolia's being renamed and reborn as a Muslim place. Anatolia, or Turkey's, positioned at the crossroads of Europe and Asia, made it one of the wealthiest and most heavily urbanized parts of the Mediterranean world. It was multi-ethnic. There were Greek communities, Phrygians, Cappadocians, Celts in the region of Galatia, Armenians and Jews. It was a melting pot, and in this urbanized melting pot, Christianity spread rapidly. You know a lot of these place names in this area if you've read the book of Revelations. Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, Sardis, Philadelphia, Laodicea. The churches experienced an intense and vibrant urban Catholicity and carried out fruitful missionary endeavors. And it was a gentle transition from paganism to Catholicism. The wealth and deep Christian roots of the region recommended it to Constantine as the place to locate Constantinople and perhaps refound the Roman Empire in the West. Anatolia had a population of around 10 million people, many of them refugees. Most of those were Catholics. It was ironic. The Muslims who conquered this region in the name of Islam came to their faith peacefully. Conversion of these warlike Turkish peoples began in the 8th century. They began the migration to the Middle East in the 10th century. And it was these people who crushed Byzantine military power in 1071, where we stand in our time transport boots, and thereby invited the Crusades. Their leaders were the House of Osman, in other words, the Ottomans, an empire that existed until the First World War. Led by the House of Osman, these peoples completed the conquest of Constantinople and created an empire and a caliphate on Byzantine's ruins, and a caliphate on Byzantium's ruins that endured until 1924. They carried the banners of Islam farther into Catholic territory than anyone had ever reached before. These people carried an ardent devotion of enthusiastic converts combined with a determination to wage war for the Prophet and profit. Converted by Sunni missionaries, these Turkish immigrants were appalled by the power, though tempted by the wealth, of the heterodox and latitudinarian Shia, who dominated much of the political life of the Middle East at the time. In the eyes of the Turkish tribesmen, among the many faults of contemporary Islamic society was its relatively greater tolerance toward Christians and Jews who lived among the Muslims or came as pilgrims to the holy places. They saw it as a less than fully committed pursuit of jihad. They sought to cut out this rot in three ways. The first was to struggle with the Shia, who were lax within the Dar al-Islam. The second was to intensify the persecution of Catholics, most especially those pilgrims, annoying hordes coming to the holy places in the Dar al-Islam. The third was a newly vigorous jihad against Byzantium. It's a testimony to the constant bleedings to which both Muslims and Byzantium's Christian forces had subjected the empire, that they pursued and achieved these objectives quickly and almost simultaneously. The Turks had been nomads. They were fantastic at horsemanship and horse archery, and they were crushingly effective at raiding and war. Their raids into Armenia in the 1020s devastated the country. Their victims thought it was the end of the world. It was difficult to repel their raiding parties, which often operated independently. You could make treaties with them, but it didn't restrain the raiders, who thought of themselves as independents. And they had the verbal approval of their overlords to carry on their assaults, no matter what treaties the overlords signed. These raids enslaved thousands of captives yearly, endangered trade and agriculture, war in Armenia and Byzantium's defenses. There was worse coming. Abbas Aslan, that's translated as the Valiant Lion. He was a Turkish prince who unified the Seljuks and was eventually to win that great victory that we opened this program with. He carried on raids of such brutality and scope that chroniclers refer to him as a drinker of blood and one of the forces of the Antichrist. There was an Armenian historian, Matthew of Edessa, and he described the drinker of blood sack of Ani, a city now known as Ardabaki. It was the capital city of Armenia. Before the raid, it had been a large, flourishing city with 500 churches. Let's quote the historian. The army entered the city,
pillaged it and burned it, massacred its inhabitants, made prisoners of all those who escaped the massacre. The piles of massacred bodies were so thick on the streets that one could not pass down the street without stepping over them. I'm quoting the historian. He writes on, the number of prisoners was not less than 30,000 souls. So I wanted to enter the city and see with my own eyes. I searched for a street where I could make my way without stepping over corpses. But that was impossible. Join me after the break on Breadbox Media, Setting the Record Straight.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
You're listening to breadboxmedia.com. And I'm Chuck Coughlin, here on Setting the Record Straight.
We had described Alp Arslan's sack of Ani, the capital of Armenia, in 1064. And the terrible sight, which eyewitnesses recorded after entering the city when the battle was over. The historians on the Turkish side corroborate Matthew's history, but Ben words reflect not a bit of regret the cost of their jihad. The annals report, they entered the city and killed more of the inhabitants than one could count, so that many of the Muslims were unable to enter the city because there were so many corpses. They took captives nearly as many as they killed. The happy news of these conquests traveled around these lands, and the Muslims rejoiced. So this report was read out in Baghdad, in the caliphal palace, and the caliph issued a blessing on Alp Arslan, the drinker of blood. The Battle of Manzikert was one of the more decisive, yet unknown battles of the early Middle Ages. Alp Arslan's forces routed Romanus' army, taking the emperor himself as prisoner. The Byzantine people panicked. Romanus' rivals seized the throne during his captivity. A civil war began. Upon his release, Romanus attempted to retake his throne and pay the ransom he had negotiated. The wars that followed were not a traditional conquest. The Turks were too few in number to thoroughly subdue a region only slightly smaller than Texas and containing millions of Christian people. So they wore them down. Continual raids, enslaving and impoverishing the regions. For the next 300 years, the population plummeted by almost half. In spite of the increasing Muslim migration to the region, much of these formerly fertile territories became pasture land. The Turks were nomadic. They didn't live in cities. So the cities fell into ruins. They lived in tents. Anatolia became a wasteland under the rule of its new religiously intolerant and alien masters, losing Anatolia permanently crippled Byzantium. This broke the eastern shield of Christendom. Once they finished with eastern Christendom, the gateway to further European conquest was wide open. Now, as I said at the beginning, it's a cliche, even among educated historians, who claim the Crusaders scarred the imagination of the Muslim world for centuries. This is simply incorrect. Bernard Lewis, one of the foremost Western scholars of Islam, has demonstrated that Western Christendom remained a subject of relatively little interest to Muslims for centuries after the Crusades. In spite of what we saw as hard-fought campaigns of the Crusades, Arab and later Turkish ignorance of even the most basic aspects of European geography and culture during and after the struggle would make a modern undergraduate blush. For a century, Western Europe remained a frontier area for Muslims, against which they continued to wage successful wars until almost the beginning of the modern era. Beyond that, it really held very little interest to them. But Christendom paid dearly to hold its own in the face of the jihads. The wars that Islam waged against Christendom degenerated into remarkably dirty wars that often empowered the worst impulses in both faiths. For Christians, these struggles opened up a Pandora's box of evils. They provided a renewed impetus to popular anti-Semitism in the Middle Ages. And even for Islam, the fruits of victory were often spoiled. Some people say they were tolerant, but this tolerance was heavily mixed in with contempt. The pressures of jihad that called forth the West Crusades led Muslims to abuse their power over Christians and Jewish subjects under the Dar al-Islam in campaigns of forced conversion, pogroms, and other brutalities. In the modern era, as the pace of Islam's advance slowed and the tide began to turn in West's favor, the Dar al-Islam's tradition of tolerance absolutely collapsed. They'd been slightly magnanimous as victors, but as losers, another part of their nature came out. Muslims have never established tolerance as a key part of their religious culture. And of course, the Crusades in the 11th century helped delay Islam's further advance westward. Then, in the face of Islam's even more successful jihads in the 15th and 16th century, Christendom succeeded in garnering power and resources by colonizing the Western Hemisphere and sidestepping the Dar al-Islam status as the middleman in trade with Asia. This was the reason for Columbus's voyage, was to go west rather than try to go through the Islamic territory, through Dar al-Islam. It was an ingenious move. Just go the other way around the globe. And by the way, people for 1,000 years had known that the world was not flat, that it was a globe. That's another myth. I'm hoping that you haven't heard it the first time from me. It's a myth only believed by people who know nothing of history. So by coming the other way around the globe, Christendom eventually broke Islam's hegemonic power in Eurasia. Christianity was doing great, but Christianity was all Catholic. And Catholics then turned their own militarized struggles for religious security inward during the Reformation, and unintentionally undermining Christendom and leaving a secularized Western Europe in its wake. It was the Reformation, the Protestant Reformation, that brought about secularization. So this created an imbalance in the other way and strengthened and built up a Dar al-Arab more resistant than ever. It was ironic then that the success of the jihads ultimately strengthened a Dar al-Harb, house of war, more resistant than ever to the advance of Islam. So jihad is as terrifying as before. Perhaps you're starting to see from this discussion that the technique we call terrorism is actually something very ancient. It's pre-human. When a group of small predators want to prey upon a large animal, they simply harry it to death. Slowly and persistently, at irregular intervals, keep driving it forward, never allowing it to rest, causing it to abandon getting a full drink of water. It did not start out thinking of itself as prey, especially not the prey of such insignificant and small predators, but they have made it prey. They give their prey no peace or no rest, or even the ability to graze for a sufficient time in order to sustain itself. They just keep it going for a few days or a week or 2 weeks. And even very small animals can prey on very large animals that way. It doesn't matter how powerful they are. The predator just approaches, harrying its prey, and then draws back. And then comes again. No doubt you've seen this technique of predation in wildlife specials. You'll see that's what wolves do. You see that's what Nile monitors do. You use fear. The buffalo is a huge animal. If you approached him directly, he could easily kill you. The Aboriginal Americans just stampeded large groups of buffalo to rush off the cliff, killing many more than they could eat. But it was such a large animal. How else could you make such a large animal your prey? You inspired annoyance, then you inspired fear. Then you inspired exhaustion, then you inspired terror. Your weapon was inside them, in their minds. Before man had civilization and even tools, he was able to make large and dangerous animals his prey because his intelligence made him more dangerous and more powerful. The technique the jihad is using against us is nothing new. It's something very old. For hundreds of thousands of years, men hunted in small bands of 5 to 11 men and keeping the animal moving, keeping the large animal off in an ungulate, keeping it moving until it collapsed. Perhaps there's a parallel here with what we call terrorism. It's just predation. Perhaps the secret of the jihad is they are thinking like what they are, predators. And we, Christians, are thinking like what they have made us, what we have let them make us. We are thinking like prey. We flee. And our fear rises. And all they have to do is keep up the pressure and they will harry us down. If we don't feel that threatened at first, because we believe our power lies in our weapons and technology rather than our spirit, then that's actually part of the advantage they have, that we do not see the danger in having a slowly deflating spirit. We do not see the danger in slowly falling out of love with ourselves, with our country, and with our God. We in the West are a very advanced civilization. I'm very proud of that. But the Byzantine Empire was overthrown, and it was also the most advanced civilization in so many ways. Byzantine civilization was corrupt, and like many corrupt civilizations, highly advanced. Certainly, in its military organization, it had a wealth of military scholarship that allowed the effete Greek-speaking emperors to recruit soldiers of hardier stock and to train and direct them with consummate skill. Upon this foundation of a relatively small but highly professional army, the great civilization of Byzantium rested. But eventually it did not last.
1453. It's like the tolling of a bell. 1453. The fall of Constantinople to the Ottoman Turks. But what of Jesus' promise? The promise that was tied to the appointment of St. Peter as the first pope. Thou art Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. But the gates of hell did not prevail against it. For with the later Middle Ages came a great flowering over the Catholic Church. It rose to a triumph over the evils of the Dark Ages and reformed itself. The church would rise to take arms against the predatory Islam. Beau Bourbon would preach a crusade and reproach the knights of Europe for exhausting themselves in petty quarrels with each other. It was the dawn of the age of the Crusades and the rise of the magnificent Christian knight. This is Setting the Record Straight. We're taking a break on breadboxmedia.com. I'm Chuck Coughlin.